Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Black lung disease, technically called co-workers pneumoconiosis, is caused by coal dust and, as it progresses, makes it harder and harder for coal miners to breathe. It was thought that black lung was a thing of the past, but a joint investigation by NPR, the Center for Public Integrity, and the Charleston Gazette has revealed that black lung is back and it's affecting younger coal miners more than ever before. I'm here with the WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson, and we're joined by NPR's Howard Berkus and Chris Hamby of the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
Erica, I'm going to begin with you because you have some clips of Howard and Chris's NPR piece that on this topic.
Yeah, I thought we'd start by just starting with where the story started.
The freshest indications of the resurgence of black lung are found in 24 autopsy reports, like the one on a coffee table in a gray house outside Nyoma, West Virginia. Each of its 8 stiff and stapled pages list one name in bold black letters: Quarles, Gary Wayne, age 33, cause of death, smoke, soot, and blast injury in the explosion 2 years ago at the Upper Big Branch coal mine. The details draw soft sobs from Gary Wayne's mother, Patty, whose pant leg hides a tattooed image of her son. But it's an entry on page 6 under significant findings that shocks the lost miner's dad.
He had black lung. Been in the mines for 13 to 15 years and already considered having black lung nowadays, it's unbelievable.
So here we have a 33-year-old man who died at Upper Big Branch already with black lung. Howard, what made you decide to start your story with Gary Wayne Quarles?
Because that's where my interest in black lung began, and because the autopsy reports from the Upper Big Branch explosion were really shocking when it came to the findings about black lung. 71% of the miners who had enough lung tissue for testing who died at Upper Big Branch had signs of black lung. Two of them were in their 20s, even younger than Gary Wayne Quarles. Several of them had less than 10 years underground, less than Gary Wayne Quarles. And for there to be that kind of occurrence of black lung, at least indications in the x-rays, for people with that amount of tenure underground and that age was really shocking to the black lung experts who've been following this for a long time. That's what piqued my interest, and that's when I started looking into it.
And so before we get too much into this, Chris, can you tell me a little bit about what black lung is?
So black lung, you would get that by... Miners get this by breathing dust in the mine atmosphere, basically when this large equipment chews through the coal and the rock, and it generates large amounts of dust. Now, they breathe this, and over the years, it collects in their lungs, and as it gets worse and worse, the lung becomes shrunken, shriveled, scarred, and black. It's tougher and tougher for them to breathe. And in the later stages, they have to choose between eating and breathing a lot of times. They're afraid to fall asleep because they are afraid they may not be able to get enough air. They have to sleep sitting up. One doctor described it to us as a diabolical torture to die of this disease.
And it's basically something that does kill the miner eventually, right?
If it doesn't kill them, there are complications with it. A lot of times it puts tremendous stress on the heart, causing heart failure. There are all sorts of other ways that you can die, but ultimately, yes, black lung has killed thousands of miners.
So in both of your reports, you talk about a resurgence of black lung. This is a disease that people for a long time thought was going away. There were drops in it. Just give me some background, either of you. When you say resurgence, what kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a doubling of the cases of simple co-workers' pneumoconiosis, the basic level of black lung, as indicated in X-rays collected by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health in the last decade, a doubling in the last decade, a quadrupling of the most severe forms of the occurrence of black lung in an area that includes eastern Kentucky, southern West Virginia, and Virginia. since the 1980s. So this is a significant increase in these occurrences. And I should note, by the way, that some of this should sound familiar to listeners in Louisville, because the Louisville Courier-Journal first talked about this phenomenon back in 1998 with an amazing series on black lung, and then a few years ago did a follow-up. And what Chris and I did was burrow down into some data that we were able to get from the Mine Safety and Health Administration, from federal records, that documented this phenomenon more, and also showed more about why it was occurring and problems that were occurring in the enforcement of the regulations that are supposed to control exposure to coal dust.
Well, and let's hear really briefly from one of the men you talked to, Mark McCowan. He is in Virginia, right?
Mark McCowan lives in Pounding Mill, Virginia, right on the West Virginia border. He's 47 years old now. He spent 21 years underground.
My name's Mark McCowan. I was diagnosed with a complicated form of black lung disease in 2005 when I was 40 years old. 14 months later, I took another X-ray and it progressed. After I quit work, the disease has progressed further to the worst kind now.
Mark McCowan is 47 now, and he looks healthy, just sitting there on his living room couch in Pounding Mill, Virginia. But walking his hilly yard, he says, or trying to mow the lawn, or simply holding his two-year-old grandson leaves him gasping for air.
I say, little buddy, I got to put you down for a few minutes. And he's learned to run a little bit. He'll say, run, Papa, I'll run. He wants me to chase him. And I can't. I said, give Papa a minute. I might be able to in a minute. And I face Mount Everest every day. Sometimes I make it to the top, and sometimes I don't.
And so you can even hear him, you know, struggling for breath in that little bit of sound.
You know, Erica, we sat with Mark McCowan for probably 3 hours, and the interview itself was tough on him. By the end, his voice was raspy. His breathing was much deeper. But we walked away from that interview sort of struggling for breath ourselves. You can't help but suddenly become conscious of your own breathing when you hear Mark McCowan struggling for breath. And you know, he's counting the days. His biggest hope is that two-year-old grandson he talked about, that Mark will live long enough so that his two-year-old grandson will develop enough of a memory of him that he'll be able to remember him.
And Chris, you did some of your reporting here in Kentucky. Can you tell me a little bit about the Markham family?
That's right. I focused much of the piece that I did on a family of miners. The patriarch is Ray Markham, who's 83 now and has been drawing benefits for black lung for about 30 years now. He worked in the mines in a different time, a different era, when there were no real dust controls. The environment was much different. The 1969 law was supposed to have changed this. It was supposed to have implemented the first dust controls. And the idea was ultimately that black lung would be virtually eradicated. Of course, Ray Markham doesn't have to look very far to see that that hasn't happened, because all three of his sons went into the mines, started working after these controls went into effect in 1969, and all three of them have black lung today. One of them has the most severe form at age 51. He already has the most severe form and has had 8 pieces of his lungs removed. The other one, the youngest, at 50, is at the most severe stage of the simpler form of the disease, and his doctor has already discussed with him putting him on oxygen, and this is at age 50. And then the third brother is comparatively more fortunate. He has a lesser form of the disease, and he's 59. But, you know, the doctor who evaluated them said to me, you know, this should not happen. There should not be men like this today.
Well, and so this 1969 law, I mean, a hard-fought law, like you said, was supposed to protect coal miners and was supposed to get rid of black lung. So what's gone wrong? What happened here?
Well, what happened is a couple of things. One is the law wasn't terribly strong to begin with. It contained loopholes in which mining companies could essentially negate a violation issued by the Mine Safety and Health Administration for a failure to limit coal dust to federal limits by taking five additional samples. The mining company itself would take coal dust samples, coal mine dust samples, and then be able to average them. And what that was able to do is you'd have a coal mine, maybe two coal miners exposed to excessive dust, but then you'd have three others who weren't. And you would negate the fact that the two who were exposed, and the violations for that would disappear. And Chris analyzed data that we obtained from the Mine Safety and Health Administration on that. Chris, do you want to mention what you came up with?
Yeah, so when you look at the dust sampling database, which we had to obtain under the Freedom of Information Act, what you see is that from 2000 to 2011, there were 53 individual valid samples that indicated that a miner, 53,000 samples that indicated a miner had been overexposed, had been exposed to too much dust. And then you look at the violations that were ultimately issued, and there were only 2,400 during that time period. So you compare the 53,000 to the 2,400. Now, that's largely a result of the fact that what Howard was describing, a large number of those overexposures are simply just going to go away by the fact that you're averaging five samples.
And so a coal operator could hypothetically be perfectly legal, be following the law perfectly, and still miners would be exposed to these unsafe levels.
Oh yeah. The law permitted overexposure and underreporting.
But
it didn't end there. What we also found was this, what appears to be a widespread gaming of the system by coal mine operators, where when they do conduct their own sampling of coal mine dust, the devices that are used, they're called dust pumps, to measure coal mine dust, they're supposed to be hung on the miner as the miner is working, you know, at their station. And wherever that might be, at a mining machine or wherever. But what we found is that there are many, 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 many cases of dust pumps being hung in clean air returns instead of at the coal face, or in offices, or in lunch buckets.
Howard, we're up against a break here. We'll let you continue right after the break. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heller. We're talking about the resurgence of black lung in the Appalachian coal fields with Howard Berkus from NPR, Chris Hanby with the Center for Public Integrity, and WFPL's Erica Peterson. And Howard, sorry to interrupt you a while ago. You were talking about some of the testing procedures that are in place.
Well, the point I was making is that there has not been honest sampling of coal mine dust by all mine operators, and that there has been a significant fraudulent sampling of mine dust, so that even though there was a legal way, you know, to avoid accurate sampling, coal mining companies also engaged in illegal ways of sampling dust. In fact, close to 200 mining company officials and contractors were prosecuted for that, and at least through 2002. So it's a system that was not geared to accurately measuring coal mine dust and not geared to really preventing the kind of exposure that causes black lung from the very beginning.
Well, and I want to play really quickly this clip from your second piece in the series, which I thought does a really good job to show kind of the steps operators will sometimes take to get around these requirements.
Richard Allen was a federal mine inspector underground in West Virginia when the new law first took effect. He remembers a strange question about a mine official's office, which revealed bogus sampling for coal dust.
What color is the man's carpet? It was blue, and it was showing little blue fibers in each sample. And they cross-referenced the fibers in these samples to that carpet and found that he was sampling in his office.
Mining companies and federal inspectors put sampling devices called dust pumps on miners underground. But almost every miner we talk to tells of dust pumps tucked into lunch buckets or under clothing or out in clean air returns away from coal dust. That's where a company foreman told David Neal to hang his dust pump when he worked underground in West Virginia in most of the 1980s.
And then we'd come back and they'd say, well, you might want to wear that, you know, for about a couple hours and I'll come and get it. And you wear it for a couple hours, and then they'd come and get it and take it, put it back over in the clean air. You know, maybe if we didn't do it this way, they'd come in and shut the mines down. And then we'd be out of work.
And that's obviously a common sentiment in the coal fields that if, you know, if a miner speaks out about safety or health issues, the mine will shut down. You know, even if they don't lose their job, the mine will shut down and they won't have a job. So now we're getting to the final couple of minutes here. So we've got laws that have loopholes. We've got operators who aren't following the laws. Can one of you talk a little bit about some of the factors you discussed in your stories that that are making miners exposed to more dust?
I think, well, one of the important points here is the geology of the eastern Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia, the central Appalachia region, is that they're increasingly grinding up more silica into dust, which is found in rock that surrounds the coal. So over the years, the big, thick seams of coal have been essentially mined out. So now the operators are going after these thinner seams, which means that they're cutting more and more rock. Now, when they grind up this rock, that means miners are breathing more and more silica dust, which is more toxic to the lungs than the coal dust is, actually, and can cause faster progressing disease like what doctors are seeing. And then at the same time, you've got the more powerful equipment, which can generate more dust more quickly, can cut through more rock more quickly. It can make seams more accessible. And then you've got longer work hours. Miners now are working more than they used to. 10 or 12-hour days, 6-7-hour weeks are now common. And so, you know, those two things working in conjunction, I think, explain a lot of it.
Anything you want to add, Howard?
Well, no, that's really what it all amounts to is there's more exposure given the longer work hours and longer work weeks. There's more toxic material that miners are breathing. Nothing that, you know, respirators haven't worked well for miners. There's really no magic bullet that has come that has been developed. And so it all comes down to the regulations. And if the regulations aren't robust enough to begin with, if they're not enforced well enough, and if there isn't enough of a crackdown on mining companies that violate the regulations, then you're going to have what's happened, which is 70,000 coal miners dead from black lung since 1970, $45 billion spent by the federal government and industry since then on compensation. That's a huge death toll and a big bill to pay for something that was supposed to have been controlled starting in 1969.
Well, I mean, and obviously you know this through your reporting on Upper Big Branch, Howard, but I mean, even when with other mine safety laws, you know, making sure that coal operators do follow the laws and, you know, and MSHA's enforcement is a huge, huge task with, you know, with mines all over the country. And I mean, so what's it going to take putting a federal mine inspector in every mine at all times to make sure the laws are being adhered to?
Well, you know, Mark McCowan, the black lung patient we heard from a little earlier, that's his solution is, you have mine inspectors there all the time watching how much coal dust is produced and watching the testing of coal mine dust, the sampling. He also suggests that every mine in the country go through some sort of a process in which you determine what is the reasonable production, maximum production that would take place in that mine, and what would also generate excessive levels of dust, and then that mine would have a standard based on that mine of production, and mine inspectors would be there to make sure they don't overproduce and overexposed. But the Mine Safety and Health Administration has already told us they don't have the resources to have mine inspectors doing that kind of detailed work. They don't even have the resources for mine inspectors to take over the inspection process themselves when it comes to testing for coal dust. So and sampling for mine dust. So, you know, unless they get more resources, I'm not sure anything's going to change. There is a rulemaking that's proposed by the federal agency, but it would still permit this kind of self-policing that has been abused in the past.
What stories did either of you hear that didn't make it into your final pieces?
You mean in terms of miners?
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many. You know, we spoke with a number of miners, and it's just heartbreaking how their lives are ruined, how retirements planned, you know, trips to, you know, to the tropics with the wife, you know, that they've planned for decades as part of retirement. They can barely get out the front door now. They can't mow, you know, people can't mow their lawns. They can't hold their grandchildren, like Mark McCowan described. And these are not old men in terms, you know, we're not talking about 70 and 80 and 90 year old coal miners. We're talking about 40 and 50 and 60 year old coal miners. It's just absolutely tragic.
I think one of the most heartbreaking things for me was one particular miner, David Neal, who lives in West Virginia, who is actually still driving a coal truck, but he's out of the mines, but he has black lung. He's in his early 50s. And you know, has all these plans for eventually getting out, moving south, becoming an electrician, and just talking with him and his wife, you see that they have these ambitions for the future. And then you ask them, where do you think that you're going to be in 2 years if you've got this advanced form of the disease? And it's almost heartbreaking to see the reality set in their faces.
And that's going to have to wrap it up for this segment on the resurgence of black lung. I want to thank Howard Berkus of NPR, Chris Hanby with the Center for Public Integrity, and WFPL's Erica Peterson for joining us to talk about this. Thank you all very much.
You're welcome.
There's more information.
Thanks for having us.
And you can hear Howard's and Chris's reporting and read it. A link to that is at our website, WFPL.org. Again, thanks to all of you for joining us. This is Byline on WFPL. We're going to switch gears now as Tuesday, the Louisville Metro Council Planning and Zoning Committee is expected to consider a proposal to change the process under which historic sites in Louisville are declared landmarks and thus given certain protections. Actually, the panel, as you'll hear, will consider two proposals, the original ordinance proposed by Councilman David Yates and a compromise version put forth by Councilman Tom Owen. And joining us to talk about it are WFPL's Devin Katayama and Bob Griffith, who's a board member of Preservation Louisville, which opposes changes to the current landmarks ordinance. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Let's start with you, Devin. Just kind of give us a little overview of what's going to be on the table
sure.
for Tuesday.
You know, as we all know, this has been going on for a few months now. The final two ordinances that are being proposed are very similar, except the major contentious provision, and that is giving Metro government the final kind of say in any landmarks decision. Currently, it's the Landmarks Commission that decides what is deemed landmark status, and that's also accompanied first by a petition, if it's not the property owner who's requesting the hearing, by 200 people. Anyone in Jefferson County can sign this petition. What these new ordinances will do, first, they both agree that 101 of the 200 signatures will come from either one of two places. First, the council district where the landmark site is proposed, or two, 1 mile radius from that potential site. And that was a compromise provision that was worked out over the past few months. That has changed several times, but going into Tuesday, that's what the council members are going to be looking at. Councilman Tom Owens' bill includes that. Councilman David Yates' ordinance includes one more provision, and of course that is the Metro Council's ability to have override any Landmarks Commission's decision, and that's what they're going to be looking at.
So is there any inkling at this point as to what might emerge from the committee?
At this point, it's difficult to say. The committee, I mean, there, about half of the council is signed on as a co-sponsor to David Yates' ordinance. But of course, you know, the committee needs to pass it itself. I talked to Mr. Yates yesterday, and he says as long as any ordinance is passed from that committee, the full council will have its hand at making any adjustments that it sees fit. So going into that full council meeting, potential full council meeting, around half the council is signed on as a co-sponsor to Mr. Yates' ordinance.
Bob Griffith from Preservation Louisville is here. Mr. Griffith, again, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. And, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming. And your organization, of course, has been very vocal through this process. Kind of go through with us some of the issues that your organization has with this.
Well, first of all, I'm not just a board member of Preservation Louisville, although I am that. I'm also the chairman of the Kentucky Heritage Council, mm-hmm. Which is a statewide organization and actually is appointed by the governor. I guess our concerns have been multiple. The first concern was the way the process began. Without much notice to anybody in the community, this was sprung on us on very short notice for a proposed first reading in February, with another reading then to follow almost immediately with no public hearings. Fortunately, there were members of the council who believed that there should be more public input, and that was a very important part of what happened. Since then, there have been a number of changes in the proposed ordinance, most of which have actually been pretty good. So what we now have is a pretty stark difference between the Yates proposal, which includes what it calls a review of decisions by the Landmarks Commission, and one that doesn't have that provision in it. And I can say, as both chairman of the Kentucky Heritage Council and as a board member of Preservation Louisville, that we are opposed to that provision.
Well, what prompted this change? Why did Councilman Yates make this proposal?
Well, in 2009, Colonial Gardens was granted landmark status. It's mm-hmm. since been sitting around. People haven't been really forthcoming with developing that area or that structure. And some residents around the area don't really appreciate the fact that it really hasn't been developed. So I guess Councilman David Yates' idea is that if it's in the best interest of the community, that Metro Council should be able to override the Landmarks Commission's decision. Obviously, the Landmarks Commission's interested in preserving structures that mean something in the community. And then David Yates' position is, well, let's look at it from our community in the sense of the greater community, the structures that are built up, people who live by these structures that might be deteriorating. So that's the main concern for Mr. Yates when it came in February.
And do we have some tape with him? Do you want to?
Yeah, he kind of explains the idea of Metro Council having general oversight of the Landmarks Commission and a little bit of how it's going to work.
We've talking about making government better. We've seen some problems when we don't have checks and balances and oversight. And what this does is this gives the authority to have oversight on the commission if and only if there's a trigger of the majority of the council calls it up. So if you get one or two members who want to have that oversight, it's not enough. You actually have to have a majority of the Metro Council asked for it to be brought up. It keeps it from hands tying up, and these boarded up properties sitting for decades on decades until they fall down.
And in previous ordinances or previous changes to this ordinance that's going to be proposed on Tuesday, there is different language. The original language that was that Metro Council needed to ratify the decision, essentially say, pass an ordinance saying, okay, yes, it is an official landmark. Now this language is kind of, it does the exact same thing essentially, but it forces the Metro Council to pull the item from the Landmarks Commission's decision and to get a majority of council members, 14 council members, to say, let's challenge this decision instead of just ratifying the final decision.
He's brought up Colonial Gardens, which, for full disclosure, I live around the corner from there, and I ride by it all the time, and I wish somebody would do something with it. But what's your organization's response, Mr. Griffith, to some of these places that sit idle for a long time?
Well, it has basically nothing to do with the Landmarks Ordinance. Landmark status and status, if you can get it, of being on the National Register of Historic Places actually gives a site the opportunity to get some very important Kentucky tax credits. This change, as I see it, wouldn't have any effect on whether Colonial Gardens or some similar place would be developed. That's obviously up to the owners. The owners of Colonial Gardens, who are not from this area but live in Georgia, as I understand it, have not tried to take advantage of any of the tax credits which would be available to it, in spite of offers that many people have made to help them do that.
And on a side note, I think the last I heard, the Colonial Gardens was included in the study of the New Cut corridor that could offer some promise to someone that's possibly interested in turning it into something. So we'll see what happens there.
What I find interesting about this whole process, since I've been going to some of the council meetings, I've had several discussions with various people who have input in this issue, was the throughout the process, people from both sides were saying how fair the process was. Once, you know, we started getting past the first controversy, how fair the process was between the dialogue of the council members. Obviously, it's split almost, I wouldn't say 50-50, but half the council members seem to be signed on to David Yates's ordinance. And there came to a certain point, Councilman Tom Owen and Tina Ward Pugh were very opposed to this. They still are. And we have a piece of audio we're going to play from Mr. Owen, who kind of explains how the compromise came about.
My position is one that involves what I believe is a read of my council colleagues, which is a read that suggests that there are going to be massive changes in this ordinance. The will currently exists on the council to make those changes. So the question becomes, how can you reduce the impact of those changes through negotiation and compromise as much as possible?
And that compromise he's talking about was the compromise of allowing the 101 signatures to come from a smaller pool of residents closer to the landmark site. He's not willing, obviously, to compromise on the provision of giving Metro Council full oversight of the final decision.
And as it stands now, those signatures can come from anywhere in the city, I guess,
right,
in the metro.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Griffith, are there any elements from where you sit of the current landmarks ordinance that you would like to see changed that are perhaps not being addressed in this ordinance?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. The ordinance change does propose a change, the new ordinances, that I support. So this isn't a completely negative position that I have on this. The one of the big problems that we've had in historic preservation in Louisville over the last few decades is that the landmarks ordinance process is a little bit in conflict with the way you get a demolition permit. And under the demolition laws, basically you have to decide within 30 days whether something is worthy of being landmarked or not, which is a very tight schedule. The proposed ordinance, both versions of it, changes that to make it tie in with the decision about landmarking. And I think that all preservationists support that as something that makes for a more realistic process. What we really are worried about is something that has always been a decision that's made by the Landmarks Commission, which is composed of people who are architects, historians, archaeologists, and planning professionals who are trained to understand and educated to understand the criteria by which something becomes a landmark, having that substituted with people who have no such training. I think that is going to lead to bad results, frankly. And I think that people who have not been trained in this sometimes do not understand what the criteria are. And I think that's going to be a big problem in the future with a politicization of the entire process, which we are very worried about. I was so worried about it that I actually wrote a letter to Mr. King and copied the mayor on it as chairman of the Heritage Council, warning that if this ordinance passes in a form which gives this kind of political weight to the process, that Louisville may well lose its status as a certified local government, which would be a very sad thing because Louisville has been such a leader in historic preservation in the state and around the country.
So as it stands now, the petition is brought up and signed. The signatures, I guess, are verified and goes to the Landmarks Commission, and that is the final, at this point, the final say?
Well, actually, that's not right. The Landmarks Ordinance was changed in the last 3 or 4 years to include an appeal process to Circuit Court. And this doesn't change that, and it also provides for the same kind of appeal from any decision that the Metro Council would make. The problem is that what might have been better would have been an appeal to the Metro Council instead of a complete review, but that's not what Metro Council wants. They want to have, at least according to the Mr. Yates, a complete say about whether something is worthy to be a landmark or not, and I think that's a mistake.
Another part of the ordinance that I forgot to mention that I think, and I want your thoughts on what you think of it, the public notification in the ordinance seems to have expanded greatly. Now, if something's going to be considered for landmark status, there has to be several notifications to the property owners, to those surrounding the area, just a handful of people. Does that strengthen the ordinance in your opinion? Is this a positive for...
I don't believe that it is a negative. Having been involved in this both as a preservationist on organizations and also as a lawyer, I have not seen any problem with notice in the way that the ordinance was working. But if people feel that there's been a problem, more notice I have no problem with.
All right, that's going to have to be the final say on it because we are out of time. We are up against a break. Thanks to Bob Griffith from Preservation Louisville and the Kentucky Heritage Council for informing us about this important topic. The Metro Council Committee meeting is when, Devin? 1:30 on Tuesday?
I believe
signing
so.
And zoning.
Yeah, 2:30 or 1:30?
You'll find it on our website, WFPL.org. Thanks again to Bob and to Devin Katayama. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett, and it is time for our arts segment. And this week we are talking Shakespeare, and here's WFPL's arts and humanities reporter Aaron Keene. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick. Thanks a lot. I'm here with producing artistic director Brantley Dunaway with the Kentucky Shakespeare Festival, which is the oldest free outdoor Shakespeare festival in the United States.
Yeah.
You guys have been putting on free Shakespeare productions in Central Park since 1960.
That's correct.
Wow. Yeah. And you've just opened your summer 2012 season with Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's interesting. Kentucky Shakespeare is the oldest free Shakespeare festival in the United States. And we're also the largest in-school arts education organization in the Commonwealth. We visit about 75,000 children in the classroom each year, which is a very unique thing for us. So.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people really know that.
No,
it's one of those behind-the-scenes kind of thing.
It really is. You know, we've spent the last, year putting together a strategic plan, meeting weekly, and really kind of digging through the archives and who we are and what we are and why we are. And we did a survey, and we found out that those that live outside of a 25-mile from Louisville know us as, you know, those Shakespeare guys that come into the schools. And and those that are in Louisville know us as, there's Shakespeare Festival in the park. And,
yeah.
And I think that, informing the community of really the vastness that we are is, a lot of folks find that surprising that we're actually in a 5-state region and that we are in Tennessee and Ohio and Indiana and here. So it's my time here has actually been kind of an awakening, not only for myself, but for the community, learning about what it is that we do and how long we've had that impact. Because, you know, we've been touring Shakespeare since the 50s.
Wow.
And, we existed for 11 years as Carriage House Players prior to doing the festival in Central Park.
And so you mentioned the new strategic plan. I know, so speaking of the local perception is you guys are 2 to 3 free Shakespeare in the Park productions every summer. And that's kind of it. But the new strategic plan calls for a new model, right? More plays, longer season, wider repertoire, turning things into sort of a destination model.
It's about a destination model, and it really focuses on three things. One is financial stability and economic impact, as far as generating an economic impact to the community. It's also about job creation. And where those deficits lie in the arts community. And the third is really kind of bridging the gap between the professional world of theater and academia. You know, it's interesting if I throw out some statistics. The arts community in Louisville creates about 7,800 full-time equivalent jobs, which is, you know, quite phenomenal, and we should be very proud of that. But during the summer months, over 90% of those people are either unemployed or they, you know, have to go off and do other jobs outside of Louisville. And I think Louisville has been spectacular at investing in the arts. But what we have have really struggled at doing is really paying attention to the industry. And that really goes beyond just actors and directors. It's also about, you know, the carpenters and the painters and the stage managers and folks like that. And we've really feel like we've identified a niche based on some statistics in 2010. You know, we looked at the arts organizations in Louisville, and between Labor Day and Memorial Day, they competed to sell on average 51,000 tickets per month with a height of about 80,000 tickets.
Okay.
And then once we get into Kentucky Derby and going into the summer, that drops to 4,500 tickets.
Yeah, so I was like, Louisville arts community really shifts in the summer to outdoor music, to you know, more community, just get community gatherings, you know, once church picnic season kind of hits. But yeah, the theaters are a lot, most of them are dark. Most of the big, you know, the big arts organizations at least take a bit of a summer break.
Right. So, you know, what we were looking at is I see Louisville and these major successes. You've got the Humana Festival, you've got St. James Festival, you've got the Derby Festival and all those things. And what the destination model is it's really a blend of the two. If I look at some of the largest gross-producing theater companies in the country, they're destination theaters. And I love to use Oregon Shakespeare as an example.
Sure, yeah. It's good,
you know, Oregon Shakespeare is in Ashland, Oregon. They're the oldest Shakespeare festival in the country. And, you know, they're in a population of 21,000 people, median income 35,000. Their nearest major metropolis is 290 miles away. Their second nearest major metropolis is over 600 miles away. They have an annual budget of $26.7 million and an economic impact of $321 million.
Wow.
Now, that is 150% of the economic impact that all of the arts groups in Louisville combined have on the city of Louisville. Now, what does that mean? What that means is the destination model really focuses on tourism, and it focuses on a larger regional impact. Now, we have that with education, and we're able to really reach out to these communities. And you've got to start asking the questions. Why haven't we done that with the festival in the summer? What they do is they really run shows in rep. The visitor has to be able to see at least three or four shows in a 3 or 4 day period. And
so when you say run in rep, running in repertory, you have a handful of shows that are running sort of at the same time, staggered times. Yes.
Correct. The ultimate goal is that we would run 5 to 6 shows, still maintaining free productions in the park, but move into ticketing, which is kind of where that revenue generating happens for us. And what that really provides is it adds a sustainability not only to our organization, but it also gives the people to have that job security. We start feeding families. We start allowing people. When I mentioned the stage managers and painters and all those people that really contribute to it, now all of a sudden they get to call Louisville home 100% of the time.
Right. So someone who builds sets for the opera, for example, and Actors Theater then wouldn't have to go on unemployment during the summer when there's no work. They could then turn to creating sets for the Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah, and that's great. You know, like this summer, for example, I think we have 5 people that normally work at Actors, and we have a couple of people that work for the ballet and a couple of people that that work for the opera. And those organizations, I have to tell you, hands down, Actors Theater of Louisville, the opera, and the ballet have been unbelievably supportive to us. And you know, anybody listening, I would encourage to really give them a pat on the back, because these groups really understand the essence of collaboration, and they understand about taking care of their community and people. And, you know, we've been able to use the ballet shop and hire some of their employees that are out of season. And the same thing with Actors. And it's really been a great relationship, because, you know, we've been able to rent apartments from Actors Theater of Louisville at a rate that really helps us in a growth phase. It's really good for everybody. And it's really been this kind of relationship where, you know, we see the benefit of each other, and everybody's been very open to making that happen.
Well, so Louisville is a very traditional city, and I think as you're probably learning, you're a little new to town, but you know, I think the folks are very attached to the idea of that free Shakespeare in Central Park production. So you say that won't go away.
No, but
it does have to be funded somehow.
Yeah, right? It does have to be funded. Yeah. And that's one of the funny things or misconceptions that a lot of people in the community have is, you know, last year a gentleman sat down in the park and he said, well, you know, it's free. It's free. I said, well, how do you think we fund that? And he goes, well, tax dollars.
Free is never free. I was like, right?
No, it's not done with tax dollars. But you know.
And city funding has dropped over the years for Shakespeare in the Park.
You know, it has. And I'm going to throw a shout out to them. And it has. I mean, it's dropped significantly over the last 5 years, you know, for us. You know, we've gone from, at one time, we received about $100,000 to help it. And I think last year we've got five.
Okay.
But I will say that they did double it for this year, for next year. So that's great. You know, this year we saw, for the first time, we received a National Endowment for the Arts grant for Shakespeare in the Park. Now, we've received those for many years in substantial amounts for education, but we've never seen it for the park. Kentucky Arts Council increased their funding to us by 22%. Metro government increased their funding to us about 98%. And Brown-Forman really stepped to the plate and saved the festival this year. They increased their contribution to us by over 300%. And it's just a start. You know, we spend about $350,000 overall doing the park. So, and it's still really kind of tenuous. You know, our board adopted in our strategic plan that we're not going to do it unless it's fully funded prior to the season, which is a complete different mindset than we've had for the last 53 years.
And so individual donors, if they want to give, I know traditionally we the intern, the apprentices pass the hat during intermission, during the Shakespeare productions, and that's great. But how are you guys building up more of a donor base? Are you looking towards an endowment?
You know, there's a couple of things. We are looking at the endowment. We are also, you know, we have a new group called the Stratford Society, and we do a lot of special things, which was founded by Gordon Strauss. And like, for example, we're taking a trip to Utah Shakespeare Festival later this year and allowing people to see what that destination model is and engaging with their board and seeing three shows. I think we're going to see Stones in His Pockets, Hamlet, and Les Mis in a over a 2-day window, and so they get to experience that. So the Stratford is one. You know, the destination model also becomes very appealing to some of the corporate donors because it becomes more of a regional aspect, and because we're hitting such a large area. Oregon sees 450,000 people at their festival. Utah sees 150. So, you know,
it turns into hotel rooms. Right. It turns into restaurant bookings.
And that's another shift for going into this destination look, is because now it opens up a lot more of the, you know, the people that we're impacting and why, and what's the return on their, you know, it's a return on investment. I mean, they are donating to us. It is a nonprofit. But at the same time, you really want that relationship that there's some benefit there. So some sponsorships, too. But the individual donor is probably our biggest need right now.
Okay.
You know, I'm sitting at home on the couch and I look at my wife and I'm like, I need an angel.
I just
need an angel.
We have a couple of minutes left, so sure. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the production of Much Ado About Nothing that's open right now?
Oh, Much Ado is a kick in the pants. You know, Jane Page has mounted this show a couple of times. It's actually played at Colorado Shakespeare, Utah Shakespeare, and Oregon, and I asked her to come and do it for a very specific reason. And I wanted to have something that, you know, I want people to go down to Central Park. It's family friendly. It's fun. They kick back. They wear a pair of shorts, and they just laugh, and they just live in community, and they just, you know, it's such a magical experience. And I've got a story. We don't have enough time to tell it, but why it's so important that would really kind of epitomize it. But so it's fun. I mean, it's gunslinging, and it's Gunsmoke meets Shakespeare, and it's done in such a wonderful, wonderful way that, you know, the message of what this classic heightened language is and literature is presented in a way that is so accessible and so fun. You know, we've had just a stellar cast of actors that have joined us, and it's just been an absolute blessing. I got to tell you, it's a lot of fun.
Well, if you haven't been down to Central Park in a few years, a few things have changed. There's beer and alcohol sale now. There's reserved seating if you don't like the bleachers. So a few more amenities and perks there.
Frozen margaritas and fleur-de-lis and Adirondack chairs and waiters and wine and cheese service. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I got to tell you, it's a very different, it's a different vibe, and there's really something for everyone. And, you know, concessions, and I think on Fridays and Saturdays we have There'll be barbecue and all kinds of stuff, so you can actually come down on Fridays and Saturdays, and really, we provide the picnic for you, so it's a lot of fun.
Before we run out of time, what's your performance schedule?
Our performance schedule, or this is crazy, we go every night of the week, 7 nights a week. The show, Much Ado About Nothing, goes Tuesday through Sundays. Curtain is at 7:30. There is live music at 7 o'clock as pre-show, and then Movie Mondays. Every Monday is a free movie in the park. So in Central Park, for the month of July, all the way going to August 9th, there is something to do in the park. So.
All right. We're out of time, unfortunately. Brantley, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Brantley Dunaway from the Kentucky Shakespeare Festival and WFPL's Aaron Keene. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information on topics discussed today, visit our website, WFPL.org. I'm Rick Heldick. Have a good weekend.